the hatred of being, the self-hatred of being Negro to the point of a constant violence against other Negroes.
Well, I would imagine that. I would imagine that this would be an unconscious reaction. But what I'm suggesting is that, for example, in New Orleans, with Negroes who are of fair skin, they have attempted, consciously and unconsciously, again, to create, as it were, a community, a kind of thinking, a false kind of thinking, because it's not based on realism, and. The upshot of it all is that the only thing that they have to base this artificial situation on is the color of the skin and the texture of the hair, which to me is not a satisfying standard, because after all, you had nothing to do with it. You have no personal sense of accomplishment in being fair with light skin. And when you look beyond the skin color and the hair texture, and you ask, well, what have you done to justify your existence here, then in 99 cases out of 100, there is nothing there.
Mr. Ely, what do you think of the same question put another way? And the first time I encountered this question was years ago in reading Du Bois, and now it's had many different formulations since. The split, or the possible split, in the Negro mind or Negro's feelings, one impulse being a loyalty to the fact of being Negro, to even an extreme form, say the black Muslim attitude, an extreme form of it, as opposed to the impulse to move away from it, sometimes to repudiate, to cease to be Negro, to repudiate entirely, to move away from it, to reject it, literally, if possible. This division of impulse, which in less extreme forms means the loyalty to the identity as Negro. On the other hand, an impulse to integrate Negro life with American life and with the whole Western cultural tradition, as opposed to anything that might be thought especially Negro, even with the possibility of the blood absorption, the disappearance, say, of Negro as Negro, loss in a general bloodstream as a possibility. Now, some people, this apparently is a real clash of loyalties. Some people have resolved it, find no problem. Well, it certainly was a problem for Du Bois, but he discussed it at some length, and for many other people since. Even Frazier discussed it, for instance, at some length, different places. And Myrdal discussed it, other people discussed it, in one form or another. How do you respond to that problem, Mr. Ely?
Well, I think this question is much, much broader than that of Negro versus white. I think this goes really to the basis of humanity, if you like. In that, I think everybody with any sense at all must realize that so long as we recognize differences in people, that ultimately, no matter how low a certain group of people, ethnically speaking, is at a given point in history, eventually, from the beginning, this group has been able to rise, and there's always rebellion and somebody destroys somebody else. I personally would like to think in terms of a world, really, wherein there was no such thing as race. But frankly, from what I've seen of the world in my 34 years here, I know that this isn't possible. I'm closer to thinking like Muslims today than I've ever been before in my life. I started subscribing to a Muslim newspaper for the first time less than a month ago. And the reason for this is fine and simple. The reason, rather. I was meeting with a group of white people in this city that are considered to be the power structure. I mean, people who control the banks and the Chamber of Commerce and this sort of thing. This went on for about 2 years. And I was fairly convinced in the beginning that these were people who were sincere and who really felt that Negroes were entitled to participate fully in government and in all forms of city life. But then I realized, after a while, that these people had not yet recognized Negroes as being human beings. So I'm now persuaded to believe that white America, North and South, does not consider Negroes to be human beings. I was in Washington on Monday and Tuesday, and I heard men in the halls of the U.S. Congress referring to Negroes as niggers. And I mean, this is part and parcel of considering Negroes to be something less than human. I think this is related to the situation in Panama. I think it's related to the situation in Cuba. Certainly, it's very closely related to the situation as it existed in India under the British. I think it's related to this, what really amounts to nonsense, in my opinion, about the freedom of free nations. I think that, well, basically it goes all the way into the very nature of man. And I might hasten to add that my ideas, the ideas that I hold now, ideas that were very alien to me prior to my participation in civil rights.
May I interrupt a second? I'm a recording professor. May I cut in on something else here? I have a quotation from Dr. Kenneth Clark, the psychologist, about the nonviolence program. You may have seen this opinion. He's comparing the nonviolence program with the black Muslims. This is quoting from him. On the surface, King's philosophy appears to reflect...
I think it's a question of Southern justice. In dealing with Southern justice, there's just nowhere that you can expect a white man to die for a Negro. It's that in some people's thinking, a Negro was created a little less than the white man, and this was God's way of life for the South. And with this in mind, we can't very much look to the future, more definitely in the present, with any optimism on Southern justice.
Right, you're right. The last remarks were by Ronnie Moore on the subject of Beckwith's trial.
Well, go on.
Now, we're supposed to be in business. You're waiting now.
Mm-hmm. In the clear.
I won't be long about what we're doing. I'm doing a piece for Look magazine, which will be part of a little book called Interviews with Negro Leaders in various parts of the country, not only the South, but I'll be making some of the East and Washington. I'll be going out to California, Chicago, and other places. And it'll be drawn from these interviews, and any interviewed person would have a typescript to correct, you see, because there'll be errors in the transcription from my subject. If you make errors, take it over here. So it'll be in your hands to check and see if it's accurate before it's ever put in final form. And the questions, primary question I'm concerned with is by discussing various topics to get some impression of the personality and as well as range of opinion. And I will plunge into it by asking you, if I may, Reverend Carter, as a starting point, when and how did you get involved in the civil rights program, civil rights movement? How did you get involved yourself actively in it?
Well, I'm at the Corps.
Yes.
Ruby Lumbar, that's his name. And Danny Moore. I met him at the Reverend A. Amethyst Church in the East Feliciana Parish, which is Jackson, Louisiana. And I met them on Thursday in August, at least in the 5th, because they explained to me concerning direction and vocal. And I told them that I had tried, but I couldn't get my leaders to go with me, which had been about 6 or 7 years past. We were the final committee from the Minister's Conference to go before the registrar and ask him, could we reach? But I was the only one met the appointment that they had to appoint this committee.
But no, they simply didn't turn up, as I know. They didn't come up with it.
So that chose me then. I just still don't wonder, because I know that I was a citizen of the United States, and not only that, a citizen of the parish, because I was 55 years old. I ain't never did anything to go to jail, to be disfranchised in any of the state of the parish law. And through meeting these voices, I could hear over the air and on the television, they wanted every citizen to vote. Well, after they explained to me concerning of the voting, which I wanted to do it anyway, and I was glad to meet them in order that they could enlighten me more about how to go about it. So I made agreement with them that I would go down and ask the minister. But I did tell them that I didn't just want to go by myself. I would like to have somebody to go with me. Well, at that time, it was only just me, one with them from the West Feliciana Parish, where we had another minister, Reverend Washington. He said, well, Reverend Davis said he wants the race. So we made an appointment with him to see Reverend Davis that day. And Reverend Davis sent me word to meet him in St. Francisville the following Thursday that we would go down and ask the race, which he did make his arrangement. Just like he made an arrangement for 9 o'clock, he was there. Well, a few minutes after, because I had a flat, but it wasn't far enough behind his appointment for me to get disgusted and involved. So after we met, we went down to the register office, which Rudy and Danny wanted to go with us. I told them, no, I don't think it would be necessary for them to go. I would rather to go by myself, you know, go before my people, without having the strangers with. And they said, well, if y'all go down and you have any trouble, let us know. Well, they told us why their car would be, which we didn't see the car at that time. They was walking. But they told us what type of car it was driving, which was a white car. They didn't tell us what it was. But they said it had Tennessee license on it, and it would be on 24 Highway going in Angola. So we went on down to the registered office, myself and Reverend Davis. And when we go down there, we park one behind the other. Reverend Davis parked in, I pulled it in back in. I couldn't nothing get between them. Just parked together. So we go into the registrar's office. And when we went in the courthouse, we didn't see nobody. We didn't hear nobody. It was just calm. But it didn't have any signs, you know, lighting up the registrar's office. Well, we saw the sheriff's office. We saw the jury room. We saw the assessor's office. Quite naturally, we had to inquire why was the registrar's office, because there was no name on it. We walked around a little and we couldn't find a place, and it was some labels, which were some boys serving some parish time. They had did little something there, and they had them in the parish jail, and they had them working on the courthouse there. And Reverend Davis asked the boys, said, we looking for the registrar's office. Can you tell us why that? Well, one of the boys said, oh, we are. Well, we had read that over there. I said, that's the sheriff's office. We knew our people registered to vote. So they couldn't say no more. Well, to the white man there, he said, white folks, can you tell us why the registrar's office? He said, well, it was two doors. One of us knows the only one about that different, but he just in there. He didn't tell us no special door. So we turned around and Reverend Davis went back to the assessor's office and asked him, so he just said, up there. And we went on up, and I said, must be in this hole. The Reverend Davis said to me, so now we both kept talking at the same time. So now you just listen and let me talk with you. Well, we agreed on the outside to do so. Well, we still didn't see nobody. So when we went down in a little hole, to the registrar's office, I imagine about the head of that wall there, from the main hall. By the time we got to the registrar's door, just before we got to the door, the registrar walked out the door and pulled it behind him and stood in front of the door. Said, good morning, boy. What can I do for y'all? Well, we spoke to him on, Mr. Fletcher. So Reverend Davis said, we come to see if we can register to vote. He said, well, I can't tell you no. He said, but you got to bring something, you got to show something, you got to tell me something. Now, Reverend Davis said, turned and said, well, I really don't know what you mean by that. You tell me what you mean, probably I can produce what it takes. He said, well, you got to go back home and get your two registered voters out of the walls while you live there. Well, at that time, the high sheriff had come down the hall and standing facing the small hall. That's where I'm at there. So, Reverend Davis said, well, the high sheriff knows me. He said, not only that, all of you know me here. He said, yeah, I know he called you Reverend Davis, but I couldn't swear that. I couldn't tell your staff. But by the time he said that, then the high sheriff called me. There, boy. There, boy. You boy. Well, I was looking at the register with me when he made the third call. I turned around and I said, you speaking to me? He said, yeah, you come in. So I turned around and went back out to him. And when I got out to just about where he walked off down the hall like he was going back to the sheriff's office. And he had a pencil and a card in his hand. He said, what's your name? I said, Reverend Joe Carter. He kept it right, but he made one mark. He said, what's the matter with your fellow? You're not satisfied? I said, not exactly. He said, well, if you wait, from now on, we'll be here. He's here? I said, yes, sir. He said, go back while you come. I told him to go back. He said, I ought to lock you up. Well, I didn't say anything. I just kept walking. Just before I got to the hall, he raised his voice. He said, I really ought to lock you up. I didn't make him an answer. Then he called to the deputy, Gavin, dear, don't you hear him raising his voice at me? Consider you on arrest. Well, I mean, just turn my face to him, get my arms up. And they searched me, started at my heels, and come on up, searching me. He said, take him out there, put handcuffs on him, lock him up. Then I brought my arm down, He's pretty behind me. He's a going around joke. Well, I went on out. Take me on out to the car. Face, no face, cross the top of the car, and he reached in with his hand. Got his handcuff, but he still held this left arm behind. And he shook it out of his scaffold. And he locked his hand. Well, when I heard the handcuff lock, I just laid the other one back there. So he locked me and put me in it. Told me, get in there. Well, I had put my head off and laid it up on the car. He took my head and sold it in the back of the car where I was. Him and another young white man. He's the other young white man. When he told Bill to grab me, they both grabbed me. So they carried me over to the jailhouse, and they got to the jail. And opened the door and told me to get out. Well, I had never been to the jail. I didn't know what the jailhouse door was. But I saw a hall, and Mr. Garner went in there. Well, I walked on. I looked upside the jailhouse. I didn't see no door, and I saw that hall. I went on up in the hall. So I went on up in there, and Bill asked me, he says, who been talking to you? I said, nobody. He said, you been over in Clinton, and damn, me. Who asked you? Bill Daniel. That was the deputy sheriff shot him. I ain't been no Clinton, so who been talking to you? I said, nobody been talking to me. I said, don't you know, we got radios, we got television, and I read the papers. I said, the they want all the citizens to register and vote. Can you hold the status? Let me check this wedding night. Yeah. Wedding? Okay. So, I was going on in jail. They put me in the cell. They unlocked me. Put me in the cell. So they went on back down the hall. They come back. About 10 minutes later, this young white man, which I didn't know him, he come back and unlocked the jail cell and told me to come out. So I come on out. And he told me to go on down the hall. So I went on down the hall. Well, that was the little office they had in the jail. When I got in there, the deputy sheriff, Mr. Bill, he had set up his picture where he had, so he took my fingerprint first. Then he, after he took my fingerprint, then he stood me over side the wall and he took my picture. And after he taken my picture, then put me on the stairs, took my weight, took my height, and asked me how old I was, which the young man was kept arresting me during the writing while I couldn't operate the picture. So I told him I was 55 years, 3 months, and 5 days old today. So after that, he asked me did I have any sisters. I told him, yeah, I had to tell him why they lived out in Houston, Texas, and a brother. Told me I'm a brother in Houston, Texas, but I didn't exactly know the number, first of all, but they lived in Houston. Had to give their names. I had any daughter, any children. I told him I had 2 daughters. They both live in Scotlandsville. And I had to give my oldest daughter's house number, Forest Street, 1740, where my baby girl had just moved. I hadn't been to her house. I couldn't give him that number, but I told him, she's in Scotland. So after they did that, well, he took me on back. But when it was unlocked, they say, I still had my clothes, my hat. Then the high sheriff, Mr. Preacher, he come in the hall, and he put it back. He said, take it back, honey. You don't need nothing. They took my ass to search him again. So they searched me over and said, take all his clothes. We don't need nothing on her. Bring a uniform out there. So they went back there and got a uniform, and they made me pull all my clothes off. So when he was getting a uniform, he said, can we put him, say to Bill, put him on that shower. They gave him a shower. You must be, your ass stank. So I didn't say anything. I didn't say anything to him. So they gave me the uniform, and I went in and started pulling all my clothes. He said, who been talking to you? I said, nobody. He said, you ain't gonna tell me. I said, well, I ain't got nothing to tell you. So I pulled my clothes off, which I was giving him my shoes, but he didn't let me see my shoes. And I put that coverall on, and they went on. So a little later, he come back up in the day. He said, you ain't gonna tell me who you been talking to? I said, I ain't been talking to nobody. Well, he told me I was lying. He walked on and off. Well, I stayed there then from that time until about 2 o'clock, 2:30. They sent me my dummy down, and no spoon to eat with it. They had a spoon up in the grease up there. I don't know how long they'd been up there. The man brought my dummy to get that spoon up there and eat with it. So I said, I don't need it because I don't need this, so I just put it over on the garbage can. Well, I stayed in that jail from about 9:30 till 2:30 without water. The old faucet was broke, and you could get water out of it, but I didn't know you had to. See, I had to put all my way up on it to get the water on. And then when I get it on, I had to do the same thing to get it off, but I didn't think it. I thought it was broke all the time because the turn on was, the threads were stripped on it. So the waterman, he told me how to get the water on and how to get it off. Well, that went. All right. So after that, the attorney made it there from the Justice Department, and he talked with me after I had been hit, been pushed, anybody kept to hear me, but I told him the story how it happened. How did he come to jail? How did the attorney? He come to the jail, but he didn't come in jail. I was in there. He came just up there. He didn't come to the jail. He come to the office. And they come to the jail and locked me and brought me to the jail office. That's why the attorney talked to me then about how I was arrested and what did I say. And I told him just what he asked me, what he said. And after he wrote me up, where he left. The deputy sheriff asked me, he didn't ask me, but I told him to let my nephew know that I was in jail with a treason. Come, go, move on. But the deputy didn't make me no answer. He didn't say nothing. Well, after this attorney left, then he sent one of his traffic cops down, and he asked me did I had anybody that I could get to go my phone. I told him, yeah, well, my nephew out there with a tweezer. I would like for you to let him know. So he asked me did I had a phone. I told him, no, we don't have no phone. He said, do you know anybody have a phone that you can get in touch with? I said, well, I got one phone out there with my cousin, but she is at school or could be in Baton Rouge. I said, well, I have a fellow here in St. Francis that I can call. Well, he let me out to say I'm going back to the office where the telephone was, so I called my cousin, and they wasn't home. And I called another lady, and she gave me one of Elijah's brother's names, which I got from Elijah Pickens, so I called him and asked him to go out to get ready to go my bone. So he went and really did come to go my bone, but they told him his place was in the exemption, tax exemption, and they couldn't let him go my bone that day. They had to go through some of his things. And that's why I had a little talk with Willie, because he had been bonding out other men, you understand? So when they got to my bone, they wouldn't let him bond. So Willie left there and went to the deputy sheriff, and ask him what he called his brother. It's a bone. They go with bone. You know, I ain't supposed to have picked no trick. So we got into something with his brother, and they got their brother run off, and Willie did find him, and he told Willie he couldn't go to bone. And Willie told him, said, well, I did tell you who to win Joe's bone. I ain't going to nobody's bone. What Joe did, he said, well, I don't know what he did, said, but you called. Your brother, he the one put him in there. He said, well, that's just my legion. Said, I ain't calling nobody. My phone not over. Well, Willie left. So after Willie left, well, I just had to make myself satisfied. We got him, but Willie had seen it, you understand? So about 9:30, or a quarter to 10 that night, they come back, somebody, and got money. And so well, I don't know what it did to them, but they come in that night and called me about quarter to 10, told me to get up and they come at me. Well, I got up and they gave me a phone, I pulled the cover over the office and come back in the office. And had to sign the bond. And I had to sign that I had got my car back and all my papers, which I didn't give them all because I had a test paper that Ruby Lombard and Danny had given me. And see, before I went in there too late, I let them know that I did understand how to fill out the registration blank. Well, I had that up over my thumb drive, on my car. But I had signed the paper that I had my car back and just standing, but I was still in there. I didn't know where Ruby was on my car, but I had to sign it because they had me in there and I couldn't get out to see the car. Well, when I did get out, I looked over there before I got in the car, put my hand up there, my paper was gone, so I didn't say anything. I just come on out. Well, Ruby, he got in the car with me after I got home, and when you checked the car, see, you got the paper. Well, I said, no, I don't have a registration paper, but you see, I've been a minister, I always carry a Bible, a Star Book, and a pass of God. I keep that in that car. Anytime you see the car, you see that with a coat. See, I hardly always carry a coat because a lot of the time I be caught up on the road for after bury some baby or something, I see my books with me. Well, I went in the car, and they didn't remember their test paper. That's all they took from me. So I went on in, and after I got home, well, I had a bunch of people there waiting for me. Well, when I got home, my wife said, yo, y'all on the way down there. She said, now, if you go back down there, I'm going to meet you. I said, well, you get your clothes and sign them because I'm going back. So I said, well, I'm on my way back tomorrow. Well, we had some babies, and I don't go back. Don't go back tomorrow. So you let us sell these papers and have somebody back with you. Well, let's sell it for that time. Well, after that time, we stayed from the 10th day on, August. Well, they started a fruit. You know, training the people how to get out the papers. They started, and they couldn't move, but the people moved back to the street. Then they decided, so, well, instead of being at the church, we're going to go to the Mason Hall, and all here. Well, from Ben, Danny, and Ruby, they left home. And they didn't come around when they got to school organized. They wanted to come around. He'd been teaching us with his co-workers from that day on until the 17th day of October. After we taught that school, we arrived in the group. I think it was about 22, is that right? We asked the question, who was willing to go down to try to test the race on the 17th? Well, we had 7, we had 26 men there. Two out of each of our league parents. There was 11, Reverend Washington and Reverend Wilson. We had Reverend Carr, he was there, but he didn't stand to go, and he got up and go. He didn't stand because he wasn't wise. So that made 21. So he didn't stay up. They kept about it. He was the only thing to do. Why, he didn't stay up because he wasn't going down there. So, we kept the word of them 22. Well, out of that 22, they had one thing. Is that right? That's what they talk about on the creek. Yeah, one year later. So that's the loop. Yeah, he never did come. He didn't go with it. So the other 22, plus, so we'll come after them. We had 43 that day. So we went that race.
And when they got home, looked there for the running, and Taylor, and he left.
Yeah, upstream, Dunbar, they went into the register voter and the district attorney. They talked to him, and when he come back, he got information how they want him to do the trials he had. So the district attorney called him a bangalore about threes, and they were taking him and came back, and let him sit on the bus, and let him drive down the grave. Well, he come back and told us, so I was a couple of names who kept the register, I told him I was going to be the first man to go back. Well, he took us three names, and said, I'm getting down about 15, I think it was. They just need to take all the names, and the secretary said, well, I don't see why necessary to take all the names because Bill's already figured out to come back tomorrow and have to retake the names. Well, he could take them all. Well, we only had as much as 15 weeks to wear. That's enough. We're not giving no more names today. Well, I told him that he had so many lights, and they couldn't get to us until 2 o'clock. They told us to sit out there next door, and we were right. 12 o'clock, we were asking the realtor what color goes to cost us. I was decided to, and I was told to stand at the door, and they come back for 2 o'clock. When we got back for 2 o'clock, we would have been 3 o'clock. But when we got back and started going, the door was the front door. The white citizen, they blocked that door. We went up to that door, looked about two of them, and when they got near to them, we all had to let somebody go, and they blocked the door. Well, we had to turn around, and even they stood at the door, closed the door. No, they didn't close it, they didn't say anything. See, just before we went up to the door, we got a little coach out there, and a wide set, about 2 steps ahead of here. They didn't say anything, but they saw past the steps, from one side to the other. And the door was climbing up to the high room like you. Well, we had to come up the steps to get to the door. And when we heard it climb, just like my hand, and we set it up there close together, and when we got there, they didn't block it, let's go back. We turned around, and we used from the courthouse, steps, and come back to the street. And goes down to the coast. Then they had a fire there on the west side of the courthouse, running from the yellow door, and we all went to the store on it. But they turned the corner here, down to that door. Over here, some more FBI, somebody gave them a silver. And that door. We had to get in the chair with a pen. And when